But for myself, as a black person, I feel like that the positive things that have come to me from being an American have outweighed any disadvantages that I may have had because of my skin color. And
amen to that. And you know what else I have discovered over the years, Carol? It's fascinating. I can live in a colorblind society where race is a non-issue more among conservatives than I can among liberals. Liberals traffic in identity politics, and I have found in conservative circles it is more of a non-issue than it is among liberals.
It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
My guest today is K. Cole James, president of the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank founded in 1973. Now, K has been involved in public life for many years as an administrator and policymaker. In 2001, President George W. Bush appointed her as director of the Office of Personnel Management, where she served until 2005. In addition, Ms. James has served as the Virginia Secretary of Health and Human Services and as the Dean of Regent University School of Government. Now, I'm a native of Virginia, and Kay James happens to be a native of Virginia who's black, conservative, and Christian. She's a woman who has lived the American dream and experienced the sense of accomplishment that comes when one becomes the first of their race or gender to reach an important milestone. So throughout her life, it has been a life of being a first in many areas. And so today, I'm going to be talking with Kay about two of her books and also her vision for the Heritage Foundation. We will start with her memoir, published in 1992, titled Never Forget, The Riveting Story of One Woman's Journey from Public Housing to the Corridors of Power. In 1995, she published a second book, Transforming America from the Inside Out. Transforming America deals with difficult issues like abortion, AIDS, homosexuality, racism, and poverty. In 2001, she wrote, What I Wish I Had Known Before I Got Married. So, Kay, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate that introduction. But I have to confess, all these years that I have known you, known of you, this is the first time I realized you were from Virginia.
I'm from southwestern Virginia, or Bedford County.
Oh, my goodness. I met my husband in Roanoke.
All right. I grew up in Roanoke.
Oh, my word. Well, you know, I'm glad that public policy brought us together.
I am too. And so your story, in some ways it parallels my story, but then my story, I did not have the blessing of being raised in a strong Christian family. And my family were by no means middle class, but then I know you grew up in the project, and so there was a lot of poverty there.
Absolutely. My early years were spent with my mother and brothers, and when I turned school age, around 5 years old, my mother had more than she could handle with six children, and she said to me one day that as her only girl, she wanted me to have all the opportunities that she could give me, and so I went to live with her sister, who was a school teacher. And I will never forget what my mom said at that time. She said, whether it's fair or not fair, a little boy can play in the gutter and get up the next morning and put on a white shirt and nobody thinks anything of it. A little girl can't do that. And she says, I don't want you playing in these gutters. I want you out of here. And those were the words my mother said to me as she kissed me on my forehead and sent me off to live with her well-to-do sister.
That is amazing, because my own experience is that in my family, the boys were favored. And my mother has said at times that little girls could get into more trouble and boys were easier to raise.
Wow. Yeah, I think that a part of my fight and tenacity and confidence today comes from the fact that I had five brothers and had to fight for a place at the table and for my voice to be heard in the family. So I many times I've wished I had a sister, but I think God in his infinite wisdom gave me exactly the upbringing I need for the work that he was calling me to do.
Now, was there a father in the picture?
You know, he was in the picture frame, but not in the picture in focus. My father suffered under the disease of alcoholism and so was in and out of our lives. And I vaguely remember him as a child, but did not reconnect with him until I was grown, married, and had children of my own.
Well, I mean, that's kind of similar to my family. I'm one of 12. We all dropped out of school. I married at 16, and there was a lot of alcoholism in my family.
Wow. Well, when we get together for that lunch coming up later on, we're going to have a lot to talk about.
We are. And one of the things that you've written is that you see your life as a metaphor for Black survival in America. And so you wrote this many years ago, but what did you mean when you said that?
When I said that, you know, I think, you know, what was going through my mind is that my story is not all that unique or different. And in my life, you see, it's a metaphor for everything that you see going on in our community. The pathologies, the hurt, the pain, the triumph, it's all there. But you know what? I think it's there in each of our stories.
I would agree. And tell us how your upbringing and experiences have affected how you've raised your children, and also maybe the messages you give to young people when you are out and about talking with them.
You know, I think I saw so much dysfunction in my early years that what became one of my life's dreams was to have a stable, intact family. And so I yearned for home and hearth and what I saw on television when I was watching Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and all those shows. You know, I really wanted to come home and vacuum with pearls on and heels, because that's what they did on television, not knowing that real people didn't really live that way. But I think it gave me a vision for what I wanted. So when I did get married, my husband and I were so committed to building a stable family environment, and home and hearth meant everything to me. And I think I tried to build for my children all the things that I missed. I even remember, you'll laugh at this, I even remember when they were teenage kids, and when my husband and I got married and we struggled in the early years with not a lot of money. We couldn't go to the mall to see Santa Claus. And I took him one Christmas. I said, look at here, you're going to go sit on that man's lap, and I'm going to get this picture of you guys sitting on Santa Claus's lap. My son said, Mom, you realize I'm 16 years old, right? So I think I had a desire to have all of that for my children, since I missed it entirely.
But I mean, that's not something you can do alone. And I realize the faith part of your life, you know, that's one thing that distinguishes it from my life. But how did you end up with the man that would share the same vision and would be as committed as you to having that family?
I can't point to anything but a great deal of prayer. You know, I really wanted, I accepted Christ when I was a senior in high school, and I wanted him not just to be my Savior, but to be my Lord as well. And to have him as Lord of my life meant that I turned over my life to him for his guidance, his direction, and living my life by his values and principles. And so, you know, I knew the kind of man that I wanted to marry that could share my faith, share my desire for home and hearth, share my passion and love for this country. And so that's what I prayed for. And I know that it will sound odd by today's standards, but I will tell you that I met and married my husband in under 6 months. We knew instinctively and immediately that that this was the one I had been praying for and waiting for. And, you know, in case any of your listeners wonder, that was 47 years ago, and we're still going strong.
Well, you know, I've heard many such stories, and I do believe that when God is involved in it, that he has an ability, you know, to let both people know. And so I know of people who have been married many, many years like that, and it's their story. They knew instantly.
Oh, yes. Well, I was a little blind. I didn't catch on right away. But we met, and 3 months later, we were engaged. And 3 months after that, we were married.
That is great. We'll have to take a brief break. And then when I return, I would like to discuss your 1995 book, Transforming America from the Inside.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
I'm back with Kay. And Kay, in 1995, what was going on when you wrote Transforming America from the Inside?
Well, you know, there was a great deal of angst in our country, probably not as much as there is today. And we were a lot more focused on what we used to call back then family values and issues, and people were concerned about the direction of the nation and a whole set of issues that were commonly called, you know, the social issues. And I really wanted to address them because I felt like in the Christian community especially, we thought that the answer and the solution for all of those issues were in the political arena and political process. And I just wanted to write something that said, you know, those issues have to be resolved from the inside out, not by imposing legislation and law. And we had to win people to our side, not just to impose through legislation.
And if you were writing that book today, would you still focus on the same issues, or how would you change the issues that would be your primary focus?
Well, it was interesting. I have spent a good portion of my time in the black church and a good portion of my time in what I would call white evangelical circles. And it was intriguing to me that in black churches, the issues that mattered most and that determined whether or not you really were a solid person of faith is how you viewed the issues of race and poverty. And in the white church, the issues were largely what your positions were on issues like homosexuality and marriage and abortion. And I thought that at the point of the cross, all those issues are important to God's people. I would only say that a cataclysmic change has taken place in our country on some of those issues, but I think we're at some levels even more divided than we ever have been. And people have gone to their respective tribes and their respective corners based on how they feel about these issues, and they come out swinging and fighting. And I think back in 1995, when I originally wrote that, we were willing and able to have conversation and discussion and understand that thoughtful, caring people may disagree, but we had the opportunity to persuade someone of our point of view or perspective. But I think in today's culture and environment, we have lost the ability to do that. We question each other's integrity if we don't think exactly the way, if you don't think exactly the way I do. We question our ethnicity and whether we truly are black enough if we have a differing point of view or perspective. We try to shut down anyone who disagrees with our opinions. And so I think when I originally wrote the book, it was to engage in a conversation. And what I see in the culture today is that the conversation is over and a fight has broken out.
I would agree.
And that really grieves me. That really does grieve me.
I would agree. And it seems to me that in 1995, we still respected the free speech aspects of the Constitution. And that was something that I think made it possible for people who disagreed. And also within the Democratic Party, there were a fair number of conservative Democrats, and so you could always get enough conservative Democrats to form some kind of coalition. I don't believe that's the case today.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And during those earlier days, probably before 95, I think I had left the Democrat Party by then. But there was a place for me as a pro-life person and a person who didn't mind invoking the name of God. And, you know, now it has become so polarized and so hateful. You know, it's just very disturbing.
Well, I noticed, you know, in your memoir that some of what you wrote about, you were being attacked as someone who had forgotten where she came from. And back then, people were questioning your blackness. And neither one of us are considered black by the definition of the liberal left. We are white people.
They can call me white all day long, but you know what will never change? I am as black as they come.
I know. But I mean, I've been told many times that I'm not black.
Because. Well, you know what? The liberal left has made a point of saying that people can self-identify. And I defy anyone to say that they love the black community, care more about black issues, care more about, you know, some of the issues that face these struggling communities and marginalized people than I do, because they just don't.
And what I find today is that it really isn't about race. It's so much about social class, because if you really break down all the problems that are affecting blacks, they're also affecting poor whites in Appalachia, poor whites in East Tennessee. And so if we could actually just focus on the issues, I think that we would find a lot of common ground.
You know, I'm absolutely sure that that's true. And I think that the reason that we can't see that, or people in certain communities don't see or understand that, is because they are so isolated in their own communities that they don't realize that people in other communities are suffering the same kinds of issues as they. And so we don't have as much sympathy or empathy, mostly because we don't have the knowledge. I think people just don't know that a poor person in Appalachia faces many of the same problems as a poor person in an urban community. I think it's important to add to that that even with that, however, layered over those common differences, the African American has the added burden of race along with that.
Well, I would agree that you can't change your skin color, even though you may self-identify as something else. But for myself, as a black person, I feel like that the positive things that have come to me from being an American have outweighed any disadvantages that I may have had because of my skin color.
And I will say amen to that. And you know what else I have discovered over the years, Carol? It's fascinating. I can live in a colorblind society where race is a non-issue more among conservatives than I can among liberals. Liberals traffic in identity politics, and I have found in conservative circles it is more of a non-issue than it is among liberals.
I mean, I found the same thing. And when I look back at my mentors and the people who encouraged me, for the most part, they were white conservatives. And the people who put me down were white liberals. And so it's the, quote, progressives that are leading the fight, supposedly, for blacks and other disadvantaged groups. And they're the ones that engage in the most racism and the most oppression. I've witnessed this in so many different forms.
Oh, as have I.
Well, when we look at, you know, the racial tensions today, what are your thoughts about what we could do, if anything, to heal the race relations that seem to be at their lowest point today?
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, since we are both women of faith, I think it starts in the faith community. Because we understand forgiveness, we understand second chances, we understand redemption, and I think that those of us who are within faith communities have an obligation to demonstrate to the rest of the world what good race relations look like. And for those who don't have the ability to forgive, to practice redemption, to practice compassion, we have a responsibility to walk that out so that they can see that it is real and can take place. Beyond that, I think that we can continue to have the conversations, to make ourselves available to answer questions, to not be afraid of tackling the tough issues. A lot of people don't want to even have a conversation about race today, and I think to get beyond it, we have to have that conversation.
I agree, and people often ask me, well, how do people in the black community receive you, or how do they treat you? And I tell them, I don't have a problem with people in the black community, that when I go to events, when I get invited to events, when I talk with ordinary black people, there is not a problem. The problem comes from other people that have an agenda in keeping people divided.
You know what? That has absolutely been my experience. I love my community. I love being in my community. I love being with my people. And my people are American, so I don't care if they're black, white, purple, or green. I feel good to be a part of the community called America. But I, you know, do I have a problem with black folks or in other minority communities? I really, truly do not.
Well, I mean, I think what you find and I find is that they are, quote, progressives. And those progressives, and again, many of them are white, they are the ones that stir up the racial tensions against black conservatives.
Yes, I think that has largely been my experience. When I go into largely all black audiences, I am received warmly. I am welcome. That just has not been my experience.
Well, we're going to take another break. And when I return, we will talk about your vision for the Heritage Foundation and also some ways that people can help you.
Are you wondering what we can do about immigration? Then get your copy of my newly released book, Debating Immigration, the second edition, available at Amazon, Cambridge University Press, and all major booksellers.
back with Kay Cole James of the Heritage Foundation. Kay, before the break, I asked you about your vision for the Heritage Foundation and also some ways that people can get in contact with you and help you achieve the things you want to achieve for America.
Oh, well, thank you for that. This is just a tremendous opportunity. When I think about where we are as a nation, I don't think there is another organization that is more well-positioned to affect the change in our country that we so desperately need. And so we are looking at ways of getting our message out and into communities. So they can help by inviting me or some of our analysts to come to events and speak and answer questions. They can help by going to the website and joining as members so that they can receive information and data. And I'm never, ever, ever too embarrassed to ask for prayer. They can help by keeping us in their prayers as we go about the work we do every day.
And what's the website link for the Heritage Foundation, the website address?
Certainly, you can just go to heritage.org. You'll find us there. And thank you so much for the opportunity to share, and I look forward to our getting together real soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. And remember, until next time, we the people can be the people who change America.